Now to the research on COVID vaccine nasal sprays, and there's a COVID vaccine tracker that's maintained by the Regulatory Affairs Professional Society. It says there are currently about 100 COVID vaccine candidates in development. Only a handful use an intranasal spray. So why is that? Conversation is right here, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 to join in. Dr. Paul Spearman directs the Division of Infectious Diseases at Cincinnati Children's Hospital. It's operating a vaccine research center that is conducting 11 clinical trials of COVID vaccines, including an intranasal COVID vaccine. Dr. Spearman, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Morning, Kate. Thanks for having me.
Well, let's zoom in on the clinical efforts for a nasal spray and what this type of, you know, how does it differ from the injection COVID vaccines?
Sure. I mean, there are a lot of theoretical reasons why you might want a nasal spray rather than something injected in your arm. You know, one of the primary things would be to generate immune responses right there where the virus first attacks the nose and the upper respiratory tract so that you can fight off the very early steps of virus replicating. So before it can get to the lung and cause severe disease. So that's something we're really hopeful for with these intranasal vaccines. You know, another really important thing that we are hopeful for as well is that we might be able to prevent transmission of virus once someone is exposed to virus. If you can control it in the respiratory tract, maybe we won't be spreading it to others. So those are two of the big reasons. Probably the third is really just the ease of administration. If we could get to something that, you know, everyone can just get a single spray up the nose or a couple of sprays up the nose, that would be terrific. So those are the real advantages that we're hoping for and hoping to evaluate in our current trials.
There was this analogy I read about yesterday in Bloomberg Business, and they said that these nasal sprays put guards in front of a building rather than stationing guards inside the building to protect it. And that kind of was like a little bit of a light bulb moment for me on what the capability of these nasal sprays could be.
That's a very interesting analogy. I didn't see that one. That's probably appropriate if we can get our immune system right up front in the nose to be guarding us against the virus. That is a good analogy.
So is every nasal environment different, though? How can you know for sure you're giving someone the proper dosage?
Well, we have to evaluate that in our phase one clinical trials and sometimes in phase two clinical trials, where we try to establish what is the ideal dosage and what type of immune response are these vaccines giving us. And then, of course, in the long run, we need to evaluate how well they're adding protection in the real world to people who are exposed to virus. So those are, you know, different steps in vaccine evaluation. And right now, most of these intranasal vaccines are really in the phase one trial where they're just initially establishing safety and in some cases getting to the right dose of the vaccine to put in your nose.
Why are there so few of them?
That's a good question. I think because it's not what you would think of as the first generation vaccine. It's, you know, usually we think of a vaccine as something you inject and you generate a systemic immune response. There have not been a large number of intranasal vaccines, you know, over the years that have been marketed. There is the live attenuated flu vaccine, which is still available and was very effective, especially in the early years after it came out. It just hasn't been really deployed a lot in recent years. But that's a kind of a model for an intranasal vaccine, was the live flu vaccine.
You mean the flu mist? Is that what you're referring to?
Yes.
And that debuted in the early 2000s. So that's been around for decades. Is that right?
That's correct. And yet we haven't seen an explosion of other intranasal vaccines, really. But maybe the time is now. We have new vectors. We have, you know, new technologies to try to get better immune responses in the nasal tract.
When you say a live attenuated, can you explain the technology that you're using in a nasal spray version of a vaccine?
Well, the technology for one of the trials, this is the one that I'm working most closely with, is a new vector that's called parainfluenza virus type 5. So that itself is a canine or dog virus that we think is completely harmless in humans. And so this canine virus is now made to express the spike glycoprotein of SARS-CoV-2, the COVID virus. And so when that harmless virus is put into the nose and now can make the spike protein, then your body reacts to the spike protein. And so keep in mind, this is not SARS-CoV-2 we're putting mm-hmm. in anyone's nose. This is just a harmless virus that has been derived from actually a vaccine that's often used in dogs for the canine distemper. So
infectious disease physician Paul Spearman with us leads the clinical vaccine trials at Cincinnati Children's as we discuss the research around creating a nasal spray to help fight COVID infection. Join in 800-642-1234. We'll pick this up ahead with Dr. Spearman here on the Ideas Network. And now we explore the science of nasal sprays and whether they're poised to be the next line of defense in fighting COVID. Some virologists think a nasal spray could tell the body to create defenses in the sinuses and the throat and allow us to start fighting illness much faster than, say, a shot in the arm. Your questions, welcome, 800-642-1234. Conversation right here, 800-642-1234. Infectious disease physician Paul Spearman is running COVID vaccine trials at Cincinnati Children's Hospital and stays with us. So, Dr. Spearman, if the trial for this nasal vaccine goes well, what is the path forward for it? What do you expect a positive outcome to yield for a nasal spray?
Yeah, I think our first outcome we're really looking at is that this is safe and well tolerated, and then that it induces a really good immune response, both in the nasal tract, but also systemically. We want to see that it can boost responses of individuals who've received other COVID vaccines like the mRNA vaccines, because I think that's where this would really be useful. So someone who has already developed some immunity, but you know that the antibodies maybe decline over time, and then you give an intranasal dose that potentially could stimulate those antibodies again. And so you get both systemic and local responses and provide, we hope, enhanced protection because of that mucosal protection in the nasal tract.
You see a real booster potential here, perhaps.
That's exactly what we're looking for. And so if we can see that in the current trial that we're doing, then we would go on to larger trials that eventually would get us to discussions with the FDA about what it would be required to get this vaccine authorized as a booster or eventually licensed as a booster. So that would occur later this year. Right now we're in the phase one trial, really establishing the safety and the immunogenicity.
Couldn't you envision a nasal spray vaccine potentially being available for people to take at home?
Oh, that's a really good question. It would make sense that could be done. I don't know if that would be part of the licensure. We'd have to think about that with the companies that are developing these vaccines, you know, whether that could be an at-home vaccine versus one that you'd get in a pharmacy or in a doctor's office.
Right, because there is a barrier for people. They have to go somewhere to get that COVID vaccine. They have to either visit the pharmacy or they have to visit the doctor's office. And I'm wondering if the nasal spray could be more accessible in that regard.
You know, it is possible. I think right now we still have the restrictions on, you know, carefully managing the temperature and monitoring exactly when the vaccine is given and that sort of thing. But as time goes on with these trials, that's a really good consideration, Kate. I think we should discuss that with these companies that are developing the intranasal vaccines and see if that's part of their plan.
Well, switching gears just a bit here, as you work at a children's hospital, when do you expect that children age 6 months to 5 years will qualify for a COVID vaccine?
Yeah, that we get a lot of queries now, as you can imagine. We have to say that we don't really know. As everyone knows, Pfizer and Moderna have already submitted data to the FDA that the FDA is reviewing, but the exact timing of when they're going to come up with an authorization for this really important age group, I just hate to speculate because we thought that may have already happened by now, and we certainly hope that there'll be some decisions on that within the next month or two. But I wish I knew better, and I could tell you exactly when that'll be available. Because, yeah, we hear from parents. Well, I just was on a plane yesterday talking to someone sitting next to me that, you know, when are we going to have this vaccine for my child? And I can feel that from all the people who are contacting us.
What was it like flying for you without masks on the airplane?
Well, I can tell you, we were going to a medical meeting, and so all of us medical people, we were all wearing masks. There were quite a few people not wearing masks, but we're trying to be good examples and follow what CDC says rather than a federal judge who makes a ruling. So it was odd feeling, though. It really was.
Do you feel that we have only a couple seconds left? Do you feel that people should continue wearing masks?
Well, I think they should decide for their own health. And, you know, I think we want to keep ourselves well. If you're in a certain like closed space or next to someone who is not masked, you know, you've got to make that decision for yourself. And I think the fact that many doctors are following this masking, even on these places where you don't have to, maybe that's a good sign of what we should be doing.
Dr. Spearman, thank you for joining us.
It's been my pleasure, Kate. Thanks for having me.
Dr. Paul Spearman is director of the Division of Infectious Diseases at Cincinnati Children's Hospital. Ahead this hour, it's Wisconsin's new clean energy plan. And we explore what you want out of this plan, how our state's energy goals hit home. News update is next. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. Now to Wisconsin's clean energy plan. Published this month, we check back in with Maria Redmond, who directs the Wisconsin Office of Sustainability and Clean Energy. The plan is about 150 pages. Cover says version 1.0, seeming to say that there will be more iterations to come. Wisconsin's roadmap for clean energy is a living document. Your thoughts on the plan, 800-642-1234. Conversation right here, clean energy plan, 800-642-1234. Maria Redmond, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much for having me.
So is that a fair interpretation on that version 1.0 on the cover, Maria, that this plan will change?
Yes, absolutely. This is the first ever state energy clean energy plan. We're super excited about that. And yes, it is a version one. We want to have multiple versions as technology changes, as we start implementing the pathways and strategies in the plan. We want to keep track of how we're doing. And so we might need to make adjustments along the way.
So before we dig into the pathways and strategies in the plan, just a mention here of the Office of Environmental Justice, Governor Evers signing that executive order Friday. Can you kind of explain how this new office will work with your office with sustainability and clean energy?
Definitely. So we will work in parallel with each other. So the Office of Environmental Justice is really going to be working on working with people across the state to make sure that we have communities that are participating in have meaningful involvement in the work that's happening from environmental laws and regulations to programs and initiatives. And so many of those programs and initiatives will be run out of my office, the Office of Sustainability and Clean Energy. And so, and will be a part of the clean energy plan. So we want to make sure that we are working in concert with the work that's going to happen out of the Office of Environmental Justice as well.
It seems like you really want to bring more voices into the fold, hear from more people. And as you created this plan, you did just that. You did these listening sessions. Is that kind of the scope there of trying to bring more people into understanding and being a part of the plan?
Absolutely. So we know historically that has not been the case, that, and especially with communities that have been impacted more by climate change, by you know, economic downturn, things like that. And so we want to make sure that everyone's got a voice in the process. And so we need to make a concerted effort to ensure that that happens, that it's not going to just automatically happen, and that we want to make sure that, you know, we're getting input and we're listening. And I do hope that when people read the Clean Energy Plan, they see, you know, some of their input was taken into consideration. We try to put together the best package to kick off the process. And we're going to continue to have listening sessions. We continue to want to engage with as many communities as possible and residents as possible. So we kept our submit, you know, your input on the website open, because we want to continue to have that engagement along the way.
One of your 7 objectives in this plan is to ensure Wisconsin is fulfilling the carbon reduction goals of the 2015 Paris Agreement. And, you know, we can't ignore that despite promises from world leaders, countries are nowhere near meeting the goals of the Paris Climate Agreement. How can Wisconsin do what countries cannot do yet?
Well, we have a great opportunity because the work is already being pushed forward. Local governments are working on climate action plans. Our tribal nations are focused in on food sovereignty and food systems and clean energy. We just have so much work already happening. And so what we really want to do is leverage that great work that's happening. I've only given a couple examples, but we're really seeing a lot of movement, even with utilities announcements for their carbon reduction goals, because they're responding to their customers and what they want. And so we really want to leverage that. And we recognize that if we support what's happening for the utilities, what we can do in communities with deployment of renewables and supporting energy efficiency and kind of changing the way that we transport ourselves around, you know, looking at a multi-sector, multi-resource approach, that we have a great opportunity here in Wisconsin to really make a difference. Hmm. So we want to make sure we're supporting what's happening, but also, you know, getting the resources needed to make sure that we can meet our goals as well.
And you've stressed before that this is not a climate action plan. This is a clean energy plan. What is the difference there?
Yeah, so the clean energy plan is really focused on the power sector and the other sectors that use energy, right? So our transportation sector, we use petroleum. Our building sector, we use a lot of natural gas, and we're using coal to generate electricity. So the clean energy plan really focuses in on how we transition away from using fossil fuels. Climate action plan spreads a wider net. So you're talking more about conservation, talking about food systems, education, things like that. And climate action plan, the governor's task force on climate change had 55 recommendations that really address that wider net. And so things like carbon sequestration and agriculture and forestry is outside of the scope of energy, but it is really going to move the needle as it relates to reducing our greenhouse gas emissions. And so that's the difference, is that this is really focused on energy and how we're using energy across multiple sectors.
Maria Redmond with us, director of the Wisconsin Office of Sustainability and Clean Energy, as we talk about Wisconsin's first clean energy plan, version 1.0. You can join in with your questions about it, 800-642-1234. Talking about energy independence and our power grid in Wisconsin, is it equipped to handle clean energy, like the inputs from solar and wind, as more and more solar and wind come online? Can our grid handle this conversion and additional load? How does that work out in this plan?
Yeah, definitely. I think that obviously utilities are looking at grid optimization, and I think energy efficiency is going to play a big role in this, that, you know, we want to make sure that we're reducing demand on in one area to help increase, as, you know, transportation gets electrified, as buildings get electrified, there's more demand. And and that we have a great opportunity with distributed energy generation resources with like solar and wind and renewable natural gas and other types of fuels that we could generate here in Wisconsin. And so the utilities, our local governments, our transmission system is we're all working simultaneously to make sure that the grid is ready and that we can really take on these new projects and new resources, because we need it. We need the benefits of being able to take advantage of what we can produce here in Wisconsin.
So talking jobs for a moment here, the Midwest Economic Policy Institute had that study in March saying if Wisconsin reaches its goal of 100% clean energy by 2050, it could grow our state's economy by $21 billion, create more than 34,000 jobs. Where do you see pockets of clean energy jobs developing as we transition away from fossil fuels?
So you're going to see, with the deployment of renewable energy, with solar and wind projects, a lot of opportunities for the building out of these types of projects, like construction projects. You'll also see energy efficiency related jobs. And you're just going to see it. One thing that the Clean Energy Plan does, which I'm super excited about, is really creates a venue for us to come together and talk with all those involved in workforce, labor unions, utilities, our state agencies, local governments, and get together and talk about, you know, the training and curriculum needed to get people into those jobs, but also like even defining what is a clean energy job, mm-hmm. how much does it pay, and how many of these jobs are going to be available, and work with everyone who's in this space, building, proposing locations, getting people, how do we get people to these jobs? So there's just this great opportunity to do some analysis around it and to ensure that those jobs are there and that we meet our goals. I know the Clean Energy Plan actually reaches a little bit further, and we are aiming for 40,000 jobs by 2030 as part of the strategies in the plan. So we really, really want to make sure that we meet that goal.
This plan has been such a huge focus of your work and this office. I can't yes. even imagine, Maria, but I want to say, so the plan is out, the baby's out, right? So now, now what do you focus on? What are the next steps here?
The next steps is implementation. We don't want this to be a document that we say we did it, right? We refer to it as a baby. We have to take care of it, and we have to, you know, feed it and nurture it and let it grow, right? And so this is about implementation. It's about, we've developed a lot of working relationships across the state, which is really exciting. And we want to continue to build those relationships and continue to build the just to get people engaged in, like, read the Clean Energy Plan, look at the different strategies and see, you know, what really speaks to you and mm-hmm. what you're working on, and let's work together. And it's one of the values of the plan is collective action. So we have to work together to get this done.
Oh, Maria, thank you for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Maria Redmond is director of the Wisconsin Office of Sustainability and Clean Energy. We have a link to the Clean Energy Plan. It's at wpr.org/mornings. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.